stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-800-585-9396.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-800-585-9396.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, but maybe you just don't know who to ask. Well, you can certainly ask us. Here's our question. Here's our phone number. Not our question, our phone number. 1-800-585-9396 is that number if you have a question about the Catholic faith. 1-800-585-9396. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for the response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Again, the phone number 1-800-585-9396. Michael McCall is our producer. He will be the person getting you on the air. Matt Kubinski is our phone screener. He'll be the first person you talk to as you're getting on the air. And Jeff Burson is handling social media for us, so you can also ask your questions via Facebook and YouTube. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Sorry, Tom, I was distracting you with pictures of my new Havanese puppy.
Yes, and you were trying to show me the picture of the puppy, and instead I got some mobile text alert something instead.
Yeah, so, I apologize.
I was like, wow, what's going on?
It was meant to be a Havanese dog.
I suppose so. So you got a new puppy in your home.
Yep, she's 2 pounds right now. We'll probably grow to 10 or 12 or 15 eventually. And, you know, the Havanese is, I think it's like the perfect dog.
You think so?
Yeah, they're just absolutely perfect.
I'll introduce her to my dog, Gus, who is a little over 100 pounds.
Oh, she'll love him.
I think it would be very, very funny to watch them interplay. We're going to lead off today with an email as we're getting these phone calls screened, 1-800-585-9396. This is Chuck from Millbrook, Alabama, who says, "Hey, Dr. Anders, I am a former Baptist who is now somewhere in between Protestantism and Catholicism." He's sort of in the twilight zone.
Been there.
All right. He says, "I'm reading the Apostolic Fathers right now.
Good.
And I'm wondering how I'm supposed to understand what I'm reading. I know the Apostolic Fathers aren't authoritative in the same sense as the New Testament, but what differentiates between how I should read, say, Paul's epistles and St. Ignatius's epistles?" And that, again, that's from Chuck in Alabama.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. I appreciate the question. So St. Paul's epistles are part of sacred scripture, so they're divinely inspired and intended by God for our edification and salvation, and they form the principal part of the texts of the sacred liturgy. Mm-hmm. So the sacred scripture is in a level just far and above any other text that you could ever encounter, because it's the product of the direct agency of the Holy Spirit on human authors. Okay, mm-hmm. The fathers of the church, whether the apostolic fathers or the fathers of the first four centuries, are not divinely inspired. They're not divinely inspired. However, they're tremendously useful because they are a consistent witness to the faith of the church in its earliest stages. We can see it, you know, hot off the presses, if you will. And the unanimity of the fathers itself is a further witness to the Catholicity of the faith. And, you know, let me illustrate this principle.
Sure.
So when I was sort of struggling with the question of Catholic faith and whether or not to become Catholic, like many people, I wrestled with the whole idea of the communion of saints, the veneration of saints, the intercession of saints, the relics of the saints. And I said, how can I make sense of this? Well, as I began to study the question historically, I saw that there was just no place I could go in Christian antiquity and not run into the practice. You know, St. Jerome, in his treatise against Vigilantius, says, does the Bishop of Rome do wrong when he offers the holy sacrifice of the Mass over the bones of the holy martyrs Peter and Paul? And not only the Bishop of Rome, but all of the bishops throughout the world. You know, he adverts to a fact that was commonly recognized and universal. Okay. And the fathers of the church have this effect. You know, so you take a doctrine, you used to be a Baptist, you know, take a doctrine about the efficacy of baptism. Does baptism really regenerate us? Does it cause us to be born again into Christ's body, which is the church, and give us grace? Well, I pick up a church father and I read this tremendous testimony about the effects of baptism. Then I pick up another and see the same thing. Then I pick up another and I see the same thing. And I see this doctrine was universally held by all the Christian faithful, you know, in the first four centuries. That's why the Council of Trent teaches that it is not lawful to interpret the deposit of faith, not lawful to interpret the scriptures in a way that contradicts the consensus of the fathers. An individual church father can be in error on some particular fact, and that's where they're different from the Bible. The Bible's not in error, okay? The church father can make a mistake, and some of them held erroneous doctrines. Origen, in particular, Origen of Alexandria, held some pretty squirrely stuff, all right, and had to be censured by later councils. But when there's a consensus among the fathers, like, say, for instance, over the nature of baptism, right, you don't find church fathers teaching the Baptist doctrine of baptism. You don't find them teaching the Baptist understanding of the Lord's Supper, for instance. All right. When there's a consensus of the fathers on some doctrine, that's authoritative for us because it's what we call the universal and ordinary magisterium of the church. Many of those fathers were bishops. They were charged with teaching the faith. And when we see the unanimity among all the bishops throughout the world and the bishops throughout history in teaching a doctrine of the faith consistently, even if it's something that hasn't been proclaimed as a dogma, all right, that itself is infallible. It's an infallible witness to the truth of the faith.
Okay. Very good. Chuck, thank you so much for your letter. I want to get to one here from Michael. And this is fascinating. David, you remember you've done two episodes of The Journey Home with Marcus Grody.
I have.
The first one was you were basically telling your story, and the second one was more a Q&A.
That's right.
As I recall. Okay, so he's referring
I had more hair back then.
Okay. You and me both, buddy. He says, Michael says, Dear Dr. Andrews, you mentioned in your Journey Home Q&A episode that cessationism was forged in anti-Catholic polemic to get rid of the Catholics, unquote. Can you trace that out a little bit more for me? I want to talk to my Catholic religion class about this. Who started that doctrine and why? What is the history of cessationism? Do you have any good quotes from its inventors that I could show my class about its anti-Catholic roots? God bless, Michael.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So, cessationism is the doctrine that miracles ceased after the preaching of the apostles. Okay, that's the position known as cessationism.
Right.
What was the motive for cessationism? It's a Protestant doctrine. It's not a Catholic doctrine. The motive was that when Luther came and proclaimed his innovative doctrines, he himself recognized that he was innovating, that he was saying things that nobody else throughout the rest of the world had said or was saying. And sometimes Luther kind of woke up in a cold sweat and said, am I alone right? And then he went, yeah, and then went back to sleep. Okay. but he recognized, and everybody recognized, that he was really kind of turning the page here and doing stuff that hadn't been done before.
Wow.
And so Catholics at the time said, Luther, how can you be teaching this stuff that nobody else in the whole world knows, nobody else in the whole world has ever said? You're really innovating. Look, if there were some sort of major change in the way we're to understand the Christian faith, don't you think God would accompany your message with miracles? Because at each of the major stages of redemption, when God did a remarkable new thing in the history of the people of God, there was usually some miraculous sign. He takes Moses and the people through the Red Sea, you know. Jesus' resurrection from the dead, the miracles of the apostles, the miracles of Elijah, and so forth. Don't you think if God wanted to radically reform the Christian faith in the 16th century, that your message would be accompanied with miracles, some sign of divine authority? And in response to that, of course, the reformers were not doing miracles. They had to have a counter to that. All right. And so the counter was, well, no. All right. For two reasons. One, they claimed we're not teaching something new. We're just going back to the way it was before.
Yeah.
Now, that's a spurious claim. All right, that's a false claim. Protestantism was not a return to Christian antiquity at all. It was a radically new form of religious faith. But they claimed, we're just going back to antiquity, right? So we don't need to be validated by miracles. And you know what? God doesn't do miracles anymore. All right, the doctrine of cessation is. So the claim itself is false. It's based on a false premise, the idea that God still does miracles. They said, no, God doesn't do miracles anymore. He just did them to set up the church and the gospel, got that formulated, and then, you know, the Holy Spirit kind of moves out of the picture, and the gospel goes forth, you know, unchanged, and we're just going back to that original formula. That was their position.
Okay.
And so the idea that God doesn't do miracles was necessary as a retort to the Catholic charge, hey, you better do some miracles to prove your right to do what you're doing, all right? Now, and you find that argument in the writings of Luther and Calvin. It got picked up again in a big way, in a very explicit way, in the 19th century by the Princeton theologian B.B. Warfield. And I believe Warfield's book is simply called Miracles, and it was largely a refutation of the claim of 19th century Protestants that were trying to promulgate healing ministry, okay,
mm-hmm.
And sort of proto-Pentecostals, if you will. And Warfield really sort of hardened and articulated very precisely what had always been implicit there in the Reformation response to Catholicism. So Warfield is your guy. And then Reformed Protestant, especially Reformed Protestant thinkers of the 20th century, have followed up on Warfield with attacks on modern Pentecostalism. If you want a history of the Protestant doctrine of cessationism, there is a book by a Protestant, by a Pentecostal scholar, named John Ruthven, R-U-T-H-V-E-N, and I believe the title of the book is The Cessation of the Charismata. I believe that's the title.
Okay.
And it was a doctoral dissertation, I believe, that he then turned around and published in book form. Ruthven will give you the skinny on the Reformed doctrine of cessationism.
There you go, Michael. Hope that's helpful for you. We're getting a lot of calls right now, 1-800-585-9396. We'll get to those in just a moment. We'll also get to some questions posed by texters. Let's see, there's one here from Nate checking in from YouTube, Anthony on YouTube as well. Again, that phone number, 1-800-585-9396. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion on EWTN.
Sharing the fullness of the Catholic faith. 1-800-585-9396. This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
This is Dr. David Anders, host of Call to Communion.
This is Father Spitzer, host of Father Spitzer's Universe.
Aloha, this is Bear Wozniak, host of Deep Adventure Radio. Mahalo nui loa for listening to EWTN Radio.
Father Larry Richards.
You know I'm from the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and both of my parents, both of them, were police officers. My father was a police officer, and my mother was a police officer. They always thought I'd be a cop, too, and in some ways I am, a spiritual cop. But we keep doing what we do, and we come from wherever we come from, it doesn't matter. Where God is calling us is what's most important.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards, Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Listen to EWTN Radio day or night. Audio on demand brings you your favorite EWTN programs, prayers, and devotionals instantly to you for free. Visit EWTNapps.com and get started today.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The fifth commandment, you shall not kill. At the heart of this commandment is an absolute insistence on the sacredness of human life. We read in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, "Before I ever formed you in the womb, I knew you," says the Lord. So every human life is sacred because it's caught up in the mind and the heart and the will and the love of God. And no matter how we're conceived or any of the circumstances, God has always known and loved every human person. And for this reason, we are to hold sacred every human life. And we are to, therefore, never murder, never kill, never seek vengeance. Of course, we have issues of abortion, euthanasia today. We have so many ways where we, in some way, disrespect the lives of other human persons. And even our own life, we have to learn to respect it as a great gift from God. The fifth commandment, you shall not kill.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. 1-800-585-9396.
If you're ready now, let's get to the phones at 1-800-585-9396. We begin with Sam in Perryville, Missouri, which, if memory serves, Sam, is the home of the Shrine of the Miraculous Medal. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
It's a fantastic place. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, it's something simple. It's been kind of on my mind for a bit now. I'm pretty new to Catholicism, really the last couple of years.
Uh-huh.
My wife kind of got me converted over. And I was really curious about the dates. So for like Christmas and Easter, was that all the way back from the time of the apostles, or is that more, you know, recent that dates kind of came about?
Okay, thanks. So the dating of Easter is very, very early, and in fact, one of the most contentious controversies in Christian antiquity in the second century was over the question of the dating of Easter,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not it was going to be on the Sunday like we have it now, where, of course, the date would have to shift to always fall on the Sunday mm-hmm. after the equinox, or whether it was going to be coordinated with the Jewish calendar and the 14th of Nisan. And there was a split between East and West, and there's actually Pope Victor in the second century got real worked up about it and actually threatened to excommunicate the Eastern Christians for not following the Roman calendar. And then bishops impressed upon him that that wouldn't be a very charitable thing to do and we should let it blow over. But there was a big controversy over it. So the question of the date of Easter is extremely early. And the celebration of Easter, this is the first liturgical feast outside of Sunday that was universally celebrated in the church. Christmas is another story. Christmas is of a later date, and I'm thinking it was, memory's kind of going blank here, but I'm thinking it was 4th or 5th century before we had the liturgical feast of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
There are arguments that have gone back and forth on why December the 25th. Taylor Marshall, who's a lay Catholic theologian, is a strong believer that December 25th is actually the date of Christ's birth, and he's got arguments to that effect on his website. You can read them. There are contrary positions, people that take the position that it was coordinated with pagan festivals and it was a convenient time, and you know, we got to celebrate it sometime, so why not December 25th? I don't really have a dog in the fight one way or another. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, the church could decide to celebrate the birth of Christ in any day if it wanted to,
sure,
and just declare
sure.
that as the feast day. But it's of later date than Easter.
Okay. Sam, thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you now, 1-800-585-9396, 1-800-585-9396. Anthony, watching us right now on YouTube, says, does the Catholic faith reject justification of faith through grace?
Absolutely not. We believe that we're justified by grace through faith.
Okay.
We have a different understanding of what the word justification means and what it accomplishes in the Christian's life.
Mm-hmm.
But the cause of justification is grace, and it's effectuated through faith. Absolutely.
Okay. Nate, also watching us on YouTube right now, says, the main thing that is stopping me right now from becoming a Catholic is that I don't see a consensus on papal supremacy of the interpretation or the of the Peter and the Keys verse in the early church fathers until 300 to 400 AD. Can you convince me?
Okay, thanks. So, you know, there's a couple ways of handling this, all right? One of them is to talk about the exegesis of Matthew 16, all right? And I grant to you that there were different church fathers exegeted the text in different ways. There's another question about whether or not Rome was considered to be the inheritor of Peter's authority, however that authority was construed,
mm-hmm.
or on what basis it was construed, I should say, and whether or not the Universal Church had to advert to Rome to have their doctrines approved. On that question, there's unanimity in Christian antiquity. And I would, you know, we can talk about some of the evidences, but, you know, one of the classic texts, of course, is from Irenaeus's Against Heresies in Book 3, where Irenaeus says it's a necessity that all the churches throughout the world agree with this church, namely Rome,
mm-hmm.
on account of the preeminence of her founders, Peter and Paul. And it's not just a Western doctrine. It's not just a Latin doctrine. We find this articulated in Byzantine theologians and Syriac theologians and Arabic theologians and Assyrian theologians. And bishops and so forth. So the fact that Rome enjoyed a universal primacy—that's a Catholic doctrine. Catholic means universal, and that's a doctrine that's held universally throughout the church. The same church that promulgated the text of the Bible. If you trust the church to deliver the right books of the Bible,
uh-huh.
you have to trust them also when they say that Rome inherited the authority of the seat of Peter. And on what basis did Rome make its claims to authority? Well, on divine authority. All right.
Sure.
So of course, like we mentioned, Irenaeus' claims because of the eminent apostles that were there, and the popes themselves, like Pope Stephen in the mid-third century, claims explicitly to sit on the seat of Peter. And that claim is not contradicted, right? I mean, if that were a heretical or novel claim, you would expect all the other bishops in the world to go, well, no, you don't. That's a silly thing to say. No, but they all admitted that.
Exactly. Okay. Appreciate that. And this is Call to Communion here on EWTN. We go now to Misty in Bloomfield, Indiana, listening to us on the TuneIn app. Hey, Misty, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a Protestant. I've been exploring Catholicism for a couple of years now, and I do hope this question doesn't get too technical for the listeners. You could clarify if you feel you need to do this as well. But my question regards the differences and similarities between, I believe it's called the assent of faith that Catholics are bound to give on infallible dogma, versus religious assent, obsequium religiosum, found in Lumen Gentium, that Catholics are bound to give on doctrines that may not technically meet the requirements, at least currently, of infallibility. To me, they seem to be the same concept. Basically, it is unquestioning agreement in either case. So could you explain the difference between these two concepts?
Sure. Now, for a detailed analysis of the levels of authoritative teaching and the nature of the assent, there is a document produced by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith under the leadership of Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, and it was his commentary on the Professio Fidei, his commentary on the Profession of Faith, and precisely what that assent of faith looks like in great detail. So, for further information, I would direct you to that document. And a second document, it's longer, touches the same question, is Donum, I think it's Donum Veritatis or Donum Fidei, I can't remember. I think it's Donum Veritatis, which was on the ecclesial vocation of the theologian. So that's a more technical judgment about the kind of faith that theologians need to exercise in magisterial statements. And it's pretty finely parsed and nuanced, and I won't go into all the details right now. But in a nutshell, we owe divine and supernatural faith to those dogmas that are proclaimed by the magisterium to be divinely taught by God. All right, and so things like the dogma of the Trinity or the perpetual virginity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the two natures of Christ or the transubstantiation of the Eucharist, these are things that we believe because God has revealed them. We believe them completely and entirely because God has revealed them. All right, and when one becomes Catholic, one says, I believe everything that the Catholic Church declares to be revealed by God. So when the Church says, this has been revealed by God, then we give the assent of faith to those doctrines as dogmas. Now, we owe the religious submission of mind and will to the ordinary teaching of the magisterium, even when it's not infallible. And what that means, essentially, is the Pope and the bishops have the job of handing on the faith, all right? In living practice, I mean, they have to operate in real time, and they have to engage in the application of the faith to the details of daily life, and they have to make judgments about how to articulate that, and that's their job. That's their job. Okay, so you know, I'm a lay apologist and a lay theologian who gets on the radio and tries to talk about the Catholic faith. All right, but I'm a private person, and so when there's a judgment about, well, what does the faith really teach on this? I often, and it may not be clear from dogmatic teachings of the magisterium, I give my judgment as a private person, and I usually try to qualify it. I go, this is my opinion as a private person, okay?
Right.
And I have no jurisdiction or authority to teach in the name of the Church on those issues. But my bishop does, okay? My bishop does. That doesn't mean he's always going to be right, all right? But, you know, if I'm in a public venue and somebody raises their hand and, you know, asks a question about the Catholic faith, and the bishop gives out an answer, I may not think he formulated like as best as he could, but I'm keeping my mouth shut. Right? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, that's his job. His job.
Sure.
And if he represents, okay, this is the position we're going to take, all right, and this is how we're going to teach this in the diocese,
mm-hmm.
That's his job. That's his jurisdiction. That's his authority. That doesn't mean that I'm going to say, well, you know, I think he said that in the most winsome way or the most prudent way possible. And if I don't think he formulated it just right, the canon law gives me the right to say, I'm not seeing how that flows. you know, Bishop, mm-hmm. I don't, can you explain this to me? Let's have a dialogue about that. And I can make my concerns known all the way up to the Holy See. All right. Oh. And so, you know, the Pope and the bishops, their job is to hand on the faith in real time, to refute error, to teach truth. All right. Most of the time, they're not operating in the domain of infallibility. Now, in between those two levels of assent, so you see, religious submission in mind and will is basically an acknowledgement that he's the Pope and I'm not, mm-hmm. all right? Doesn't mean I have to believe everything that the Pope or the bishop say in the way in which they formulated it, because there can be deficits in the way, in a particular era, the way that that a leader of the church articulates a doctrine of the faith, and there may even be misunderstanding. I mean, there can be corrections and elaborations, you know, down through time as new information comes apparent and we see things in a different light. We can reformulate, and that religious submission takes into account that lower level of authority.
Sure. Misty, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate that. Our phone number here, 1-800-585-9396. When we come back, we'll talk with Jenny in Spirit Lake, Iowa. We'll get to a few more texts, and we'll get to your phone calls, 1-800-585-9396. Call to Communion on this Wednesday, on this Tuesday here on EWTN.
Coming to EWTN Television.
On November 13th and 14th, bishops from across the country will gather in Baltimore for their Fall General Assembly. EWTN will take you there live as the bishops are addressed by their new president for the first time. Receive an update on the recent convocation of Catholic leaders, vote on several causes for canonization, and more. Live coverage of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Fall General Assembly begins Monday, November 13th at 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
No one likes to get angry, but sometimes we can't help it. Anger is a God-given response to injustice that's supposed to motivate us to address the problems we encounter. Of course, wrath is one of the deadly sins, but anger isn't always sinful. It all depends on what you do with it. For instance, anger is righteous, even godly, if it causes us to make an appropriate, proportionate, and productive response to an injustice. Alternatively, anger becomes sinful if it causes us to lash out in ways that are inappropriate, disproportionate, or unproductive. Be careful to not let your anger add to the injustice. To learn how to manage anger and all your passions more gracefully, check out my book, Broken Gods, Hope, Healing, and the Seven Longings of the Human Heart. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Listening to your program has really touched my heart, and I just see such love and beauty, not only for Christ, but for people in general in the Catholic Church. And now I feel like I need more. I want to serve God more. I feel it so much that He's given me a gift to serve and to touch people, to love people. What would it take for me to maybe look into the priesthood?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. 1-800-585-9396.
Great radio straight ahead here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Today at 4 on Cresta in the Afternoon, our friend Steve Wood will be by to talk about what evangelicals believe about grace and justification. And then Kevin Vost in the second hour talking about his book, The Catholic Guide to Loneliness. Should be a great show today at 4 p.m. Eastern, Cresta in the Afternoon here on EWTN Radio. And then, of course, tonight at 6, Catholic Answers Live. A lot of great stuff coming up here on EWTN. Back to the phones we go now for Jenny in Spirit Lake, Iowa, listening via podcasting. Hello, Jenny. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if Mary was saved from sin, how could she have also had free will?
Thanks, Jenny. I appreciate the question. So you could ask the same thing about Jesus. If we believe that Jesus was free, was it also necessary that he be able to sin? And of course, the answer is no. Jesus was impeccable. It was not possible for him to sin. And in fact, we could ask the question about the eternal Godhead. Is God free? Was God compelled to create? The Catholic faith says no, God was not compelled to create the world. the world is not a necessary emanation from God, but was God's free act of creation out of love. And yet, of course, the concept that God would need to be able to sin is, first of all, unintelligible, but absolutely untrue. The freedom of God does not require his ability to sin, no more so Christ, no more so the Blessed Virgin Mary. In the same way, the saints in heaven are radically free, absolutely free, and yet they're impeccable. They no longer have the power to sin. St. Augustine put it this way. He said that before grace comes, it's not possible for us not to sin. After we receive grace, it's possible for us not to sin. And when we're glorified in heaven, it's not possible for us to sin. Now, here's the thing. The further you advance in grace, rather than restricting your freedom, it actually increases your freedom. You become freer and freer the more grace you have. And the reason why is that freedom is something that is derived from our rational nature. I mean, this, we talk about humans having free will. We don't talk about my Havanese puppy having free will. My little dog is more or less compelled to act according to instinct, you know.
Sure.
She doesn't rationally deliberate about, you know, whether it would be better to, you know, learn not to potty in the kitchen or perhaps to chew on the, you know, the new toy we got her. She's just going to do whatever instinct says unless sure. we can habituate her otherwise. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have free will. All right. You add intellect, you add rationality to a species, and now you have the capacity for freedom. It's that ability to rationally deliberate. Well, does sin enhance our capacity for rational deliberation? Absolutely not. It's quite the contrary. Sin chains us down to the irrational demands of our passionate nature.
Yeah.
All right. And the further a person descends into sin, the less freedom they have. And there's no better illustration of this than the life of the addict who has, you know, for whatever reason, given themselves up almost entirely to the pursuit of the basest kind of physical pleasure, and it absolutely destroys their freedom. And ask anybody who's been an addict, who's come out of it, whether they feel more free or less free, you know, on drugs or not on drugs. And sometimes I've used the illustration before of the artist who is, say, free of heroin addiction, is no longer on drugs, not bound and chained in that way, and has before him, you know, a room with 100 empty canvases and all the paints and brushes he can use. No one is compelling him to paint any picture on any canvas. He's utterly and radically free to create one beautiful thing after another in total free choice of the will, and yet everything he does is good. Every painting he paints is magnificent. That's kind of what the life of grace is like. We're freed up from sin, and the Blessed Virgin Mary was like that. She was utterly free. She, you know, she didn't have to go to see Elizabeth. She could have gone and shot pool with her buddies instead, you know. Grace freed her up to go visit Elizabeth, to go look for Jesus in the temple, to present him in the temple, you know, to do all these good things that she did. They were freely chosen by her. She could have done something else, and it would have been okay. Like, it wouldn't have been a sin.
Right.
You know, unless the Holy Spirit told her to go visit Elizabeth. But, you know, it wouldn't have been a sin to do something else. But she did the better thing because she was more free.
Is that helpful for you, Jenny?
Yes, the illustration is really helpful. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I'm still working on the idea of our lady playing pool. That's quite a concept, David.
I don't know if they had pool back then. Probably didn't.
I don't think so. Our phone number, 1-800-585-9396. Here's a text now from Jay, it looks like. If God is maximally powerful and knowledgeable, why is it necessary for him to have three personalities? God could do anything with just one personality, correct? So wouldn't the additional personalities be superfluous?
Okay, I think that you are misconstruing what Catholics mean by the doctrine of the Trinity. All right. We believe that God is utterly one in his nature. All right. And the attributes of omnipotence and omniscience and so forth pertain to God in his unitary divine nature. Okay. And God is so unitary. All right. God is so one. He's so simply one that we don't even differentiate God from his attributes. All right. In humans, we can differentiate a human from his attributes. So take Tom Price over here. Tom Price has a cute sense of humor that often comes out on the radio show.
Gets me in trouble, too.
Yeah, exactly. All right. But you are not your sense of humor. And if, God forbid, you lost your sense of humor, you would still be Tom Price. right? The attribute, your humorous attributes are not your identity. God is his attributes. He is his omniscience. He is his omnipotence. That's how singularly one he is, all right? And so the persons of the Godhead, the three persons, are not super added onto his divine identity as as entailments or as they're not add-ons, right? What do we mean by a person? Well, in a human person is the answer to the question who, right? I'm looking at Tom Price. What is he? He's a human being. Who is he? He's Tom Price. All right, human nature, Tom Price person, all right? In the Godhead, there's one divine nature that's utterly and radically simple, completely one, to which nothing is superadded, all right? But in answer to the question, who is God, we say Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's a threeness to the answer who and a oneness to the answer what, all right? And the persons of the Godhead are not differentiated from one another in substance. The Father is not a different thing from the Son. The Son is not a different thing from the Spirit. Their differentiation is relational only. They differ only by relation, the relation of paternity to filiation to spiration. All right. There's nothing in our experience that's like that. There's no other reality that's differentiated in just this way. The closest analogy that we have, and it's a bad analogy, but it's the best analogy that we have, would be the differentiation within the human intellect of the idea proceeding from the intellect that contemplates itself. If you can think about an intellect, right? Yeah. not a brain, but an intellect.
Okay.
From which an idea of itself proceeds, contemplating itself. That's the analogy that Augustine and Thomas used to help us wrap our heads around how something could be substantially one, and yet there could be a division of relation within that simple unity. Hmm. Because the intellect is one. You don't have two intellects. You have one intellect. And in a sense, your idea of yourself in your intellect is coextensive with your intellect.
Okay. Got it. Thank you so much, Jay.
If you've got it, you're doing better than I do.
Well, I'm doing my best. Jay, thank you so much for your text. We do appreciate that. We appreciate your phone calls as well. 1-800-585-9396. 1-800-585-9396. Call to Communion here on EWTN, now carried on, golly, almost 400 radio stations here in the United States and over 500 around the world in English and Spanish. How do we do it? Well, we do it with the grace of God and people like you who have answered the call to start a Catholic radio station. You know, we're just coming off of our Catholic radio conference, which we held last week here in Birmingham. And, imagine an entire ballroom full of people who answered the call by getting involved in Catholic radio. It's not for everybody, but it might be for you. If you feel like God just might be calling you to start up a Catholic radio station where you live, you will need to contact Jack Williams. Here's the number, 205-795-5756, 205-795-5756. I'll give you his email as well, jwilliams@ewtn.com, jwilliams@ewtn.com. Or you can visit our website called EAR, which stands for EWTN Affiliate Relations, ear.ewtn.com. That's ear.ewtn.com. Look into it. You might be surprised. Let's get back to the phones here at 1-800-585-9396. Michael is listening in New Orleans on the Almighty's 690. Michael, what's on your mind today?
David, I would ask you this because you're a convert, but I'm Catholic and always have been. I was wondering to what end. I find this almost universal in Protestant sects or whatever, Protestant religions. To what end do they think is vilifying the Catholic Church? And I mean, it's an active part of their preaching. And I was wondering, what are they trying to do that? That increase the faithfulness of their congregation? Or I don't understand that. Could you maybe it's an opinion you have. I don't know if you answered empirically, but could you help me out on that?
Yeah, sure. Well, let me speak to you about my experience, okay? And I won't generalize about all Protestants. I'll tell you about the tradition in which I was raised, and I do think is to a certain extent representative. So, you know, the word Protestant, protest, I mean, embedded in the concept, embedded in their identity, is an awareness that the tradition was born in rejection of the Catholic faith. So the rejection of Catholicism is really integral to their self-understanding. And in at least in the way some Protestants formulate it, they see their religion as unique in world history and as contrasted with sort of the natural religious state of mankind, which is one in which man tries to justify himself or save himself or philosophize himself up to heaven. And at least in the way that some Protestants portray it, Protestantism alone is the religion of grace in which God reaches down and saves a sinful humanity that cannot save itself. And so they see Catholicism as kind of this archetypical example of this sort of worldly, natural, prideful human tendency to try to climb the ladder up to God. Right? Now, that, of course, radically misconstrues both the nature of Catholic dogma and the history of world religion, because the fact of the matter is Protestantism is not the only tradition that teaches a religion of grace that comes from the transcendent down. In fact, there was a Buddhist monk named Shenron in medieval Japan that used to teach that people could be saved by grace through faith alone in the atoning work of Amitabha Buddha. All right? I mean, he's like Martin Luther, you know, a couple centuries earlier in Buddhist Japan. So it's a false position to take on world religion, and it's a false position to take on Catholicism. But at least I've heard that case made.
Okay.
And of course, you know, Catholicism is the biggest game in town when it comes to the history of Christianity. So if you're trying to differentiate yourself, which the Protestant tradition does, you know, you take on the 800-pound gorilla, because it's against that you're trying to frame and articulate your own position. So your question, what do they want to gain? Are they trying to build up the faith of their people? Well, absolutely yes, all right, because you've got to make the case. Why is it? I mean, the $64,000 question for every Protestant is, how is it that my particular tradition only came into existence in, say, the 16th century or the 18th century or last month or whenever it is? How do I make sense of that in light of the fact that there's this 2,000-year history of Christianity called the Catholic Church? And the way you do it is you have to show how everybody before you was wrong, and your tradition was the first one to think its way out of the scriptures and to get it right. And that story's been told over and over and over again with every denomination. We finally worked the kinks out and got the thing working. All right. The other motive, I think, is more benevolent in that, well, from a certain point of view, and that's proselytism. All right. And the tradition I was raised in, we were taught to believe that Catholics were all going to hell. All right, and that it was an actual act of benevolence to convince them of the error of their ways and to proselytize them and to try to move them over into our tradition. Now, fortunately for me, that dynamic led to my conversion to the Catholic faith, because I went whole hog into this. I went to seminary and grad school to kind of train myself up to take on Catholics. And after I read the sources of the faith, I realized I was in the wrong church and I switched sides.
Yeah,
you know. But I think those are at least two motives.
It's interesting. Michael poses the question, what is the end game? Do you think the end game is conversion all around?
Oh, absolutely. You can't generalize about all Protestants.
Understood.
Right?
Understood.
But the traditional motive, yes, would be proselytism. I mean, I did a lot of work on John Calvin. That's what I did my doctoral dissertation on. And Calvin divided the world into the pious and the impious. All right. That was one of the categories. He had other categories, but one of his categories was the pious and the impious. And for him, pious meant people that practiced the reformed religion, all right, the quote unquote reformed religion of Protestant Christianity. And for him, that meant in particular the abandonment of what he would have considered to be idolatry and superstition. That is the Catholic form of worship. And people that were still enmeshed in Catholic superstition, as he understood it, were the impious. All right. And he had one goal, obviously, which was to move people from the impiety camp to the piety camp, which meant, you know, abandoning Catholicism and moving into the Reformed Church.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Michael, thank you so much for your call. That was fascinating. Call to Communion is our program here, 1-800-585-9396. We have a line open for you. We'll try to get as many calls as we can in the last 10 minutes of the show. Matthew sent us an email. It's fascinating. Hi, Mr. Price and Dr. Anders. My name is Matthew. I am 17 years old. I am discerning the priesthood.
Good for you.
But I need some final doctrinal clarification before begin pursuing religious life? I have two questions. Number one, how can we use Old Testament books to substantiate the argument of purgatory if nobody went there in the time of the Old Testament? Didn't everyone just go to either hell or the limbus of the fathers until the redemption? If this is true, doesn't the practice of Jews praying for the dead in the Old Testament do nothing for the cause of purgatory? And then number two, his second question, if Pope Pius XII declared the Vulgate free of error in matters of faith and morals, how can we reconcile the mistranslation of Genesis 3:15, notably that the woman would crush the serpent's head and not her seed, which was later corrected in the new Vulgate? Thanks for your answers. Love your show, Matthew.
Okay, thanks, Matthew. I appreciate it. With respect to your first question, so what we do know from the text of the Old Testament is, first of all, that there is a real distinction mm-hmm. between the guilt of sin that is forgiven through repentance and grace and the debt of punishment that is owed in reparation for the offense against divine justice. And that's the sort of the bedrock theological basis for the doctrine of purgatory. And that's a clearly Old Testament doctrine, and we can see it elaborated in passages like 2 Samuel chapter 24 or 2 Samuel 12, where David repents of his sin, is forgiven, and then God imposes a penance on him. Okay.
Yeah.
We can also discern from the text of the Old Testament that prayer on behalf of the dead is efficacious, right? That prayer on behalf of the dead is efficacious, however you conceptualize that, okay? And third, we can also see that purgation from attachment to sin is necessary for the vision of God. And that's clear from the psalmist, who says, what's the passage I'm trying to think of? My mind has just gone blank. I quote it all the time. You hear me all the time.
Yeah.
Who can ascend the Lord's mountain and stand on his holy hill? He who has clean hands and a pure heart.
Sure.
All right. Or, Jesus says the same thing, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. And I think we see that typologically displayed for us in the theophany of Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah sees the Lord high and seated on a throne, and he says, oh, I'm a man of unclean lips. And so God sends this seraph with a burning coal symbolically to cleanse him from his attachment to sin and so forth through the burning fires of the coal. So however the metaphysics of the thing work out in terms of the temporal location of purgatory in relationship to the limbus of the fathers, and that's a very astute question, by the way. I think the theological principles that are there articulated still hold, and so the logic of purgatory still holds. And to be honest with you, I don't think that I necessarily have to know, questions about the temporal initiation and duration of purgatory, whether there was a purgative aspect in the limbus of the fathers, all these kinds of... Since the church doesn't teach a definitive answer to those kinds of speculative questions as a dogma, we're free to speculate.
Sure.
All right, we're free to speculate on those kinds of things. Now, with respect to Pius XII's teaching on the Vulgate, I wish I had that text in front of me, because I'm just going to take it for granted that you've represented it correctly, and I hadn't got that in memory right now. Okay, but let me tell you how I'd approach that difficulty. To say that the Vulgate is accurate in matters of faith and morals is basically to say that I can adequately derive the Catholic faith from the text of the Vulgate, and that's true. All right. And the mistranslation of Genesis 3:15 does not offend against any dogma of the Catholic faith or against any morals in the Catholic Church. It's not to say that the Vulgate is a perfect translation of the Greek and Hebrew text.
Okay. Matthew, we will be praying for you and for your discernment of your vocation. Call to communion here on EWTN. We go to Rose in Buffalo, New York, listening to us today on the Station of the Cross. Hey, Rose, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'll try and make it quick. I know you're getting to the end. I got on a Facebook discussion, which is not a good thing to do, obviously, about homosexuality with somebody. The person asked if there was some church that she could attend that didn't make her feel bad for being gay or bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
And she was asking for opinions from other people. And I commented and I said, you know, no matter what church you go to, you're not going to feel bad. You know, people aren't going to make you feel bad for it. It's not like they're going to ask you as you walk in, hey, are you gay? You can't come in here. But, you know,
if you want to learn about Jesus and you go to a Bible-based church, it's not possible to find somewhere that would accept it, that it's not a sin, because that's what she was asking. She wants to go somewhere that says that being homosexual is not a sin. And I said, well, unfortunately, you won't find anywhere. And then there were people commenting that were saying, oh, yeah, you will. And then they were giving all these examples, like various churches. The only one I remember is like some Unitarian church or something. And I wanted to know, is there such a church, a Bible-based church, that actually teaches that it's, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what to say.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Rose. Appreciate it. Well, a couple of distinctions. The church does not teach that the state of having same-sex attraction is morally culpable.
Right.
So, you know, to say if a person identifies as a homosexual, says, I am a homosexual, basically, if they're making the claim, I'm attracted to members, sexually attracted to members of my same sex, that condition is not sinful. What is sinful is sodomy, homosexual activity, homosexual sex, any form of unchastity, any sexual union outside the bond of holy matrimony is sinful, and that's true whether you're gay or straight or,
yeah,
or you know, wherever you fall on,
mm-hmm,
the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
We have to live chaste lives, all right? The pure in heart will see God, all right? Now, you know, I'm not a homosexual. I'm a married man. I'm a broken married man who has disordered appetites and have, you know, my entire life, and that's why I'm a Catholic. You know, St. Augustine became a Catholic in large measure to find the grace to deal with the overwhelming power of concupiscence and to conquer his sinful nature and to live a holy and chaste life and elevate his mind to things of God, all right? Does that make me feel bad? Well, sometimes, you know, sometimes, and not just unchastity, but any clingings of the flesh, pride or anger or gluttony or sloth,
yeah,
all, you know, all the seven deadly sins, do they make me feel bad? Yeah, they make me feel bad. All right. Is that a reason not to go to church? On the contrary, it's a reason to go to church.
Exactly.
Because I want to be healed of my broken nature and find the grace necessary to live a holy and chaste, humble, faithful, devoted, servant-like life in imitation of Jesus.
Yep.
Okay. Now, in answer to the question, are there religious communities out there that teach that unchastity is not sinful? You bet. You ask me, are there Bible-based communities? Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by Bible-based. Are there communities out there that have Bibles that teach that unchastity is not a sin? I suppose, you know, you might find some Bibles in the backs of their pews. They're obviously playing fast and loose with the meaning of the sacred text, which is pretty obvious that we're called to a holy and chaste life.
Yep, exactly. Rose, thank you so much for your call. We're going to close with a YouTube question here from John. He says, my sister just informed me that her Southern Baptist church believes that Jesus is not God, only the Son of God. Do all Southern Baptists believe this?
Woo! No Southern Baptists I've ever met.
Mm-mm.
No, the Southern Baptists traditionally are extremely orthodox in their Trinitarian theology. And I think, you know, Dr. Al Mohler, who's the president of the Southern Seminary, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, would have a fit if he knew there were Southern Baptists running around teaching that Jesus was not God.
No. My own upbringing included a certain number of years in the Southern Baptist Church, and that certainly wasn't taught at our church.
You know, my first systematic theology textbook was by Millard Erickson, Southern Baptist theologian, back before I was Catholic.
Yeah, yeah.
Great theology textbook, at least as far as Baptist theology goes. And I remember very well his extensive treatment of the doctrine of the Trinity. And it was pretty straight up and down, you know, Catholic Orthodox stuff. And he was refuting all the ancient heresies and taking the Catholic line.
Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
My thanks also to Michael McCall, Matt Kubinski, and Jeff Burson. Remember, we do the show each and every Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern. I'm Tom Price. Have yourselves a wonderful day. See you next time right here on Call to Communion. God bless.